Today on The Grave Talks, the ghosts of Chattanooga. Chattanooga is one of the most haunted cities in the United States. Home to one of the most famous railways in American history, the site of a historic trade route along the Tennessee River, and the gateway to the Deep South. Chattanooga has a very haunted past, a past that still lives to the spirits that inhabit the city today. The dead do still roam the streets. Whether it's the ghost of the Delta Queen still lingering the days of the river trade, the porter who forever roams the grounds of the historic terminal station, the ghosts that have haunted the city from below through its elaborate underground tunnel system. The specter of Chattanooga's past is everywhere. Today on The Grave Talks, we discuss the ghosts of Chattanooga.
My favorite spot that we go to, and this one spot is so active that it is involved in, it's on a stop on the original tour, the Murder and Mayhem tour, and my downtown ghost hunt. It's so active, it had to be included in several different options. It's part of Underground Chattanooga. I'd say it's the most asked about place that we go to. And it is a parking deck. And I know how bizarre that sounds, but it is a very active parking deck. We go there because it is, well, it lowers down and shows the original level of downtown. There was a lot of flooding mid to late 1800s, and the solution became not building a levee or doing anything organized by city planners, but concerned citizens getting together and gathering dirt and rock and building up downtown. So this parking deck became a good way to say, hey, look, this is where downtown used to be. This is kind of the average level, and now it's been raised up to here. And you just get a glimpse of that by looking at this parking deck. But it was just so, so active that we had to dig a little deeper and say, why is this parking lot so haunted? And it turns out that, I don't know if I'm giving away too much here, Amy.
You can say what used to be there.
Okay, it used to be an undertaker's office. It was of 1894. A fellow named G.W. Franklin had opened the first African-American funeral home in Chattanooga on that spot. So I call that one of those aha moments. I think that might have a little bit to do with why it tends to be so active.
Yeah, there's a historical marker out front, and it talks about G.W. Franklin, but he had about five different businesses, and we had no idea which one that one was until I was looking through a book about famous African-Americans who'd been prominent in Chattanooga, and found a photo, and it had the address for the spot, which happened to be right there, and it showed the horse-drawn hearse right out in front of the spot, and that's when we figured out that was his business that was at that location, which made everything make a lot of sense about why we were getting so much activity there.
It was certainly an epiphany moment.
I just want to understand in historic context here of what was going on with the downtown. It had been literally buried and then raised up. Is that correct?
There had been a lot of flooding. So at first they were going to do what New Orleans did and, you know, put in levees. But fortunately they decided, no, we're going to just build the entire downtown area up one story. So everything that used to be the first floor became people's basements. Everything that used to be the second floor became, you know, the first floors. And you can still see, like at the underground Chattanooga spot where we go to, you can see the walls from the original level of the city. There are some places on the sidewalks. If you're walking down the sidewalk, you'll see the barest little top of a window right above the sidewalk, you know, where it used to be someone's first floor and was a window they could look out on. Now it looks out on a bunch of concrete.
It's really like an architectural map to that part of the city's history. When you look at the wall where they actually raised everything up during that effort, you can see that it's done by not professional bricklayers or stonelayers, but just by this guy and this guy trying to save their city. So it's an interesting little piece of the puzzle there to see how they did that.
Before they had done it, there's one of the spots we go to, which is actually Chattanooga's most famous haunting at the Reed House Hotel. It is at the intersection of Martin Luther King, which is the same as 9th Street and Broad. But before they had raised the city up, they had had a flood from the river, you know, down around First Street, that where a boat was actually able to come up to the Reed House and pick people up out of the window when the city had flooded.
When you hear a story about flooding and about a town that literally had to change the level of its city, I have to know about the history there. When those events occurred, what were most people rescued? Did they survive the flooding, or what happened?
There wasn't a lot of death that we know of associated with the floods. You know, our the ghosts that we encounter just tend to be people who had lived back during the time back when the city was that level. You can tell from their dress, because we have, you know, we and other people have seen some of the ghosts there, or had things show up in photos or whatever, and it's very old-fashioned dress. Not that they died because of the floods, but they're still hanging out at their original level.
There was a lot of damage to the buildings, though, and the interesting thing, the Cherokee, the steamboat that went down the city streets, was causing even more damage because of the water coming up higher than where the flood mark already was. So that was a bit of an issue there, and you know, one of the reasons they wanted to try to save the city.
Tell me more about the history of the Reed House Hotel that you had mentioned.
There had been a hotel on that spot since early 1800s. In 1847, the Crutchfield House Hotel was built on that spot, and there ended up being a lot of history there during the time that hotel was standing that would eventually tie in with some of the ghosts that we experienced there. For instance, it was one of the spots during the flooding where the ship was coming by, but also guests looked out one day to see a 100-foot warehouse floating by as well. So it ties in with that flood history. But again, with the ghost tie-in, in the Civil War, when the Crutchfield House was still standing, it was used as a Civil War hospital with a morgue in the basement. So I call that another one of the aha moments. And then the Crutchfield House burned down in 1967. And around 1871, 1872, I thought 1871, they're now saying 1872. But either way, they built what was then called the Reed House. And so parts of that original hotel are still there. And in 1926, they said, let's make it bigger and grander. And that's the year that they built what you see now.
Tell me more about what life was like in the 20s and the 30s at the time in that city.
Let's see, Al Capone. They say the ghost there did not bother him when he stayed at the hotel. And it's a ghost that's well known to not like men at all, but she didn't bother him. So we wonder if she was more scared of him than he was of her.
Back then, it was very much a hotel, though. You know, of the flapper era, they had, you know, a lot of Art Deco decor that they're trying to reinstate now. They're, you know, trying to bring it back to the era it was before. We're thinking that at least one of our ghosts is really going to like that, because it's not just Civil War soldiers that are there. There's the most famous ghost of the Reed House, Annalisa Netherly, is probably going to, we expect, become more active when they finish with these renovations.
Renovations tend to stir up things anyhow, so it should be good for us if that's happening.
Talk to me a little bit more about her past and her history and what life was like for her.
There's a couple of different stories about her time period. Some people say Civil War, but there's another ghost that they say is more, you know, a little bit later on. But I'm going to let Hope talk to you a little about Annalisa.
There's different, it's a big part of the folklore in Chattanooga about the ghost Annalisa Neverly of room 311 at the Reed House, but not everyone agrees on exactly who she was. As Amy said, some say, you know, Civil War time, but they're different stories. One of the lesser known stories that I've heard people talk about say that there was Annalisa that committed suicide. Other people talk about a jealous husband killing her in a fit of rage. he caught her flirting with another man, supposedly a Yankee soldier. And so he killed her in a fit of rage. And the more well-known story is a bit more sordid. And I discussed this in creative terminology to remain a lady. But the third story is that Annalisa was a lady of questionable affections, killed by an unhappy customer.
Generally, because this is the South, considered to be a Union soldier there again. Either way, Annalisa does not like men.
She does not. Neither does... can I speak about Martha?
Yeah.
Okay. Neither does Martha Brown Hewlett. She's another that we think might actually like the change in the decor, because she lived at the Reed House in the 1930s, and she had been married and her husband was unfaithful. When they became estranged, he put her up to live there at the Reed House. So, you know, that's not folklore, that's documented, recorded thing there. And she lived there all through her 30s, and Martha loved to excessively excess and things like eating, drinking, smoking, and unfortunately that led to her demise. Martha was killed at the Reed House of a heart attack.
As we get to more modern times, tell me more about what people experienced in the hotel, including the room that you had mentioned, room 311.
Well, a lot of things. It actually became such a problem with the ghosts there that employees would quit. They'd walk into the room and see a bathtub faucet just come on forcibly without any help, and they were frightened. They'd either say, forget it, I'm not ever working here again, or they would at the least say, I'm not going into this room. People would see, you know, entire shadow figures in the room, or they'd hear things, or a lot of things was water. The tap would come on, and again, the bathtub faucet. The bathtub faucet ties in with some of the stories. Most of the stories say, whether it was Annalisa or Martha, they say that she died in the bathtub. And with Annalisa, there are some gruesome ideas attached to that, but it makes sense there would be activity there in the bathroom. But just many, many things like that would happen in the room. Also, when it was still the smoking floor, people would try to smoke in the room, and they were not often successful. They either had trouble lighting their cigarette, or once they did get it lit, it was put out. Some say that's because Annalisa did not like smoking. With Martha, it might be she's trying to save someone from the fate she succumbed to.
But I've actually had people call me who had stayed at the hotel that had no idea it was supposed to be haunted, but they had had weird experiences there, and they would call me to say, hey, do you know anything about any ghosts at this hotel? And, you know, of course, I would answer, as a matter of fact, I do. And we have had our own experiences there. We have, besides our ghost tour, we also do a ghost hunt that's more like the investigations you see on TV with all the equipment. And our piece we use in our ultimate hunt, which is our, you know, top-of-the-line piece, we have an SLS X-Cam, which is one that allows you to actually see the ghosts on screen. They look like moving stick figures. It's been on one of the ghost shows featured prominently there. But the very first time that we used it, we went to the Reed House and we got special permission to go in their most haunted room, which is room 311. And we have video of this actually on our website if you want to check it out. But at one point, Hope was sitting on the bed and we said, can you touch Hope? And it said touch. We were using the Ovilus too, which talks. The Ovilus said touch, and on the SLS you see it reach out and touch Hope, which I think you said you did feel it at the time, right?
I did feel it, yeah.
But then also later on, there had been a ghost on the Ovilus that said, you know, his name is Walter. Walter follows Hope around.
Mm-hmm.
He's appeared a number of different interjected his thoughts a number of different times on our tour. Hope said, Walter, can you show back up? And on the Ovilus it said, okay. And then immediately you see it show up right next to Hope on the SLS screen. So that's just one of the experiences we've had. Hope's had many things happen there.
Yes, I've had guests on the hunt or the tour that were staying in room 311. They would oftentimes ask me to come up and investigate there afterwards. And I have done that with a lot of success. We've actually used the obelisk, the one that spits out the words based on the readings, to talk to Annalisa and Martha. And I had a really kind of odd experience with Martha. It turns out she regrets her life choices with the eating and drinking and smoking that led to her heart attack. And she realizes it's her fault for doing those things, and she regrets that.
But you've also had a group, when y'all were outside the hotel, see something, right?
Yes. One night I was on the downtown hunt, and it was a small group that night, and I had a couple and their teenage children. The children were off in one direction. The couple and I were standing with our backs to the hotel. We were really just getting started. Well, I turned the obelisk on, and it said, "Turn around." Now, that's kind of, you know, a little shocking to have actual directions with it speaking to you like that. But we did. We wanted to see what it had to show us. So the couple and I turned around, and it said, "Concrete." Now, the older part of the hotel, from, like I said, 1926, it's brick, but there's concrete addition. So it said, "Turn around, concrete." And it said, "Look up." So, of course, we're looking up, and it said balcony. There was a balcony there, and then it said right. So we knew to look to the right of the balcony. The shades were drawn, and the main light was off. There was a lamp turned on, and it perfectly illuminated this figure, full form figure, floating in the window. And I would have said, okay, there's a person standing there, except that the feet were not attached to the ground. You could see the form above the windowsill. And it's always interesting when the obelisk is working in conjunction to whatever is happening with you, because it was describing all of it. And then it would say, light off, and the lamp would go off. And it would say on, and the lamp would come back on. And it was just telling us about the figure as we're standing there watching it. And what really grabbed me about it, a lot of times, as you know, ghost experiences are somewhat fleeting. When you see it for a few seconds and then you know what you saw, but you almost question yourself because it happened so quickly. But with this, I would say we stared at that figure for probably at least a minute. And that may not sound like a long time, but when you're standing watching a paranormal experience and it's right there in front of you, that is quite a long time for something like that to happen, I'd say.
The first time you used some of that equipment personally and you saw or heard clear evidence of something on the other side either being there or communicating directly with you, what was your reaction? What was going through your mind at that moment?
Oh, it's pure excitement. I don't get scared too often because I've done this too long. I just get really excited and animated and interested. And I know, say, when the obelisk came out, I don't want to speak for Amy, but I think both of us are kind of, we're not skeptics at all, but we want to see it to believe it, you know? So, is that accurate, Amy? I don't want to speak for you,
yeah.
But... Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the obelisk is the whole reason that I started the hunt. The folks at Raccoon Mountain Caverns had said, "Hey, Amy, come on. We want to take you on a private ghost hunt through the caverns. We have this cool equipment." And I was very skeptical. I thought, yeah, this is just something that's programmed to spit out random words at random intervals. Big deal. But because it did answer so many questions appropriately on that hunt, that's when I said, oh, I got to get this. Mm-hmm. And that's how we actually started doing our ghost hunt. And then the SLS X-CAM, that time at the Reed House, that was the very first time. And we were very excited. I mean, you can hear us sort of squealing. Someone on our website had been sort of criticized us, saying, you know, well, you weren't, you know, very professional with all that squealing. But it's because we were so excited that we were getting those results. Yeah.
We didn't enjoy this, we wouldn't be doing it.
Right.
It's exciting.
I imagine when you're giving these tours, you have several people who understand what's going on and how some of this stuff works. But I can imagine there's also folks who are going to be sitting there and constantly trying to debunk every single thing that is going on around them at random. How do you handle that, and how do you try and explain and communicate what's going on is in fact real?
Oh, I want to answer this one.
Okay.
A lot of times, and Amy will tell people this, a lot of times people start as a skeptic and they don't always end that way. I don't really try to argue with them. I just kind of explain what it does and let it happen. And what happens a lot of times, I've had just total skeptics and, you know, explain how everything works and then let it go and let's investigate. And one of the most memorable times I had a skeptic just the whole night, I don't believe in this, you got somebody hiding or you programmed this or what have you. And then the obelisk said his name, and his name was not, you know, like Mark or Matter or something like that. His name was something unusual, and it said his name clearly right at him. And so that changed his mind a little bit.
You know, we've had several skeptics that that weren't still skeptics by the end of the hunt. So.
I have a kind of odd story about that. One night, I'm sorry? Okay. One night I had a complete skeptic, and I always say you do not have to believe in ghosts to go on a ghost tour or even a ghost hunt. I mean, just see the city and experience some fun stuff. And so he said, I don't believe in any of it. And I said, that's fine. It was a tour, not a hunt. And I said, just enjoy the stories and enjoy the evening and walk around with us. And he said, well, you know, that's why I'm here. That's fine. But I'm not going to believe anything you say. I'm not going to believe anything that happens. Okay, fine. Well, we were towards the end of the tour, and I stopped in a place to tell a story. And there was a brick wall, and the fella, the skeptic, he leaned back against the wall. And he's trying to act really cool and nonchalant. I don't hear you. I don't care. Blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, I watched his face change, and I watched him just jump up in the air. I mean, a few feet in the air. And he jumped up and then ran away from that wall with this total aghast look on his face. And then he went back and creeped up timidly a little bit closer to the wall and looked around. And I said, okay, I have to ask you what just happened. And he said he would lean back, the brick wall was cool to the touch, and then all of a sudden a large circle of heat started emanating from the wall, so hot it felt like it was going to scorch him. And that's why he jumped away. But even better, he said when he turned around to look back at the wall to see if he could see anything, he actually saw with his eyes, not on camera, a big, large orb kind of just hanging out, hovering above the hot spot. So at the end of that tour, I had to ask him, are you still a skeptic? And he said he had to admit there are some things that cannot be explained away.
Let's talk more about the downtown area of Chattanooga and some of its haunts, some of the places that are fairly well known for their activity, something like the Hunter Art Museum. Let's talk about that.
The Hunter Art Museum. There are several identified ghosts there. It's another place. There's a long history to it. The mansion, part of it, the original center of the museum, was built in 1904, and it has had, you know, a lot of history to it. And then there's the modern addition, but between the addition and the mansion, there are at least 5 identified ghosts there. So we have gotten some very good pictures there. I think we get, I'd say at least on my tours and hunts, I think we get the most at the underground spot that I mentioned first, but you do tend to get a lot of really interesting pictures at the Hunter as well. So it was built in 1904 by an architect named Ross Faxon, but later on, around 1920, it was purchased by Benjamin F. Thomas. And, you know, a lot of people know the roots of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, but it was first bottled in Chattanooga. And Benjamin was a partner in that venture. And when he left the house, he didn't have children of his own. He left it to his nephew, George Thomas Hunter. George didn't want to leave it to anyone because he loved the house so much. He said, you know, people make mistakes, and he didn't like the thought
of the house being wasted away. So he decided an entire organization of people might be better than one. He left it to the Binwood Foundation. The Binwood Foundation is still around and in the arts of Chattanooga. But at that time, they eventually turned that house into Chattanooga's first art museum. So it was the first, and it's now the largest collection of American art in the entire South. So pretty impressive, I think, and probably a big part of why they needed so much of that expansion. And there's a lot of artwork in the modern edition. There's still artwork in the mansion along with the ghosts.
When you're looking back on the history of that building, I guess I have to ask, is there any sort of emotionally charged event that you can put your finger on that may point to how some of this started up there? Obviously, a building like that, it can be a very emotionally charged building by itself, by people going in there, feeling various states while looking at the art and how it moves them and such. So I could see that by itself being essentially kind of a giant battery for it. But let's take a look. If you have an answer to that question of has there been anything particularly that stands out that's an emotionally charged moment with that building?
There was a woman who lived actually in the house next door, and she used to haunt that house. She had been murdered, which would account for it. Her body had been hidden in a crawl space in the house, and they only discovered it several years later when the house was sold and the new people were trying to do reconstruction. You know, they were doing remodeling and, you know, found a skeleton in there with glasses that appeared to be this woman's glasses who had mysteriously disappeared. It had made national news at the time because she was, you know, socialite type family. She used to haunt that house, and then when it was torn down, she moved next door to the museum. She's often seen admiring the artwork there. So that's that accounts for that particular ghost. But as Hope had said, there are actually five there.
Well, one, most of them are in the mansion, but there is one that is in the modern edition in some of the offices she has picked out there. And the way she's known, you might walk into an office and find a stapler flying towards your head. She likes to pitch fits and throw things around. And so in the ghost business, of course, they would call her Poltergeist. What I don't understand about this, they don't really see her. Of course, with Poltergeist, it's more the experience, and they're experiencing the temper tantrum. So if they don't see her, just the fit, how did they decide she's a woman?
Poltergeists are, you know, some people will tell you poltergeist isn't actually a ghost that's created by energy of, usually they'll say a female because, you know, more active hormonally or whatever, nearby, and usually they'll say someone that's an adolescent and that all that, you know, rage or whatever is what's creating the activity. But I believe that the poltergeist activity there has continued on for, you know, long past when adolescent activity normally would. But I think that's how they came up with the idea that it was a female, because typically they'll say poltergeist or female.
It was a corny joke. I tried.
That one has actually been experienced by one of the heads of an insurance company in town who had been there. And he was not someone that had a, you know, the kind of imagination, that would lead to him to think there were ghosts there. So for someone like that to say he experienced something, you know, there was something going on.
Have any of the other ghosts there been identified beyond just a stereotype?
Yes, George. As I said, George Thomas Hunter was so attached to his home and was worried about what would happen to it after he passed. And so I'd say because of that, he had that unfinished business. He wanted to protect his home. And so people that live across the way or visit across the river can see this one particular bay window in the back of the mansion, and they often report, and I've talked firsthand, this isn't a he said, she said, I'm sure Amy probably has, and I have to talk firsthand with people who have seen a man in that window
wearing an old-fashioned brown suit. And the physical description, of course, matches George Thomas Hunter. If you look into it, you'll find that there was a painting done of him when he was alive of him wearing that brown suit. And so a lot of people see him standing at that window, and I feel like that he's still there watching over his estate. And, you know, you hear about ghosts with unfinished business. I'd say that's his. He just wasn't ready to let go.
We do have a lot of guests that get ghost photos at the Hunter Museum. But a really funny experience that had occurred, you know, I typically will take new guides around and tell them, you know, about the ghosts in different locations. And I had a new guide, and we were there, and I was... before I had started telling him the story, this was at nighttime, and the museum was all dark or whatever. And he said, "Hey, did you see that old lady looking out of the window just a minute ago?" And I laughed because I knew who it was. That you know, I told him I hadn't been looking up there at the time, but it's a window that we do get a lot of ghost pictures out of. So then I went on to tell him about the story of the lady next door. He went and looked her up online, looked up some newspaper accounts of her death, and his jaw just hit the floor because the photo he saw of the woman, he said, "That was the woman that I saw in the window." So just one of those, you know, many weird things that we have occur on the tour often.
Events that no matter how much you look at very well cannot be explained other than it's the dead.
One night I was walking to the underground spot with my group, and I had some college boys in town for spring break, and they just went white and still when I pointed to underground and said this was haunted. And it turns out that the night before they had been out to eat and then walking back to their hotel, and they had seen an African-American man in an old style suit walking around in that area. And then they saw him disappear. They said he was walking around with an air of authority. And they didn't believe in ghosts, so they tried to pretend it didn't happen. But I basically brought him there the next night, told him it did, by, you know, saying this is a haunted area. And when what they described to me, you know, with the air of authority and the suit and everything, they had described G.W. Franklin, the owner and, you know, the one that the businessman that started that funeral home. And so it was a case of they had no idea about any of that history. They just knew they were walking past a parking deck. And then lo and behold, they actually got a glimpse of G.W. Franklin.
Do you want to talk about Southside Saloon?
Sure, sure. This was a spot years ago that was on our, we had an extended tour. Unfortunately, the saloon is no longer open at night, it's only open during the day. But if you ever want to, if you're local and you want to go in there and grab some lunch, the employees will be glad to tell you about a ghost they called George. In the 1890s, that brick building that the saloon is in, it was actually a brothel. And so, very interesting, shall I say, history to the place. The ghost the employees called George, I spoke with the obelisk when we were going there, and he told me his name was Johnny, but they liked to call him George. And it turns out he was a customer of the place during those days. Now, I wear period costumes on the tours, and I noticed he was, you know, very talkative when I would use the obelisk there at that stop. And he would talk to me, you know, maybe more than some of the male guides that would go there. And eventually I figured out that he found me sort of familiar since I was similarly dressed to some of the ladies he would visit back during those days. But Johnny was quite a character. One time, the obelisk, he said, "Eat." And, you know, you realize sometimes ghosts miss those type things. So a lady pulled out a cookie from her purse and unwrapped it, took off the plastic wrapping and set it down. And he said, "No." And we thought, "Well, what's wrong with this cookie?" And he said, "Store bought." And then we realized these, you know, ghosts are coming at you with their perceptions from their time, not ours. And in the 1890s, if you had given a man a store-bought cookie, he would have been a little offended because, you know, you need to go home and make that cookie yourself. So that was, he thought that we were, you know, being kind of rude for giving him a store-bought cookie.
Two of the waitresses there both said that they had seen George, they called him, and one of them claimed that it went on vacation with him. The other one said, yeah, George didn't show up around the saloon while the other one was on vacation. But because they had said they'd seen him, you know, we were trying to come up with some sort of composite picture or whatever of what the ghost, you know, looked like. So we had, for weeks, we had asked them to describe, you know, what this ghost looked like, and we tried, we'd send them stuff. They said, no, that's not it. Well, then we'd done a tour there one night, and we had gotten, and one of our guests had taken a photo, and it's just beautiful. It shows a man wearing a suit coat and boxer shorts, and I can assure you there was nobody dressed like that there. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was see-through. You could see, you know, behind him. So we took that photo back and showed it to the waitresses. Immediately, they said, that's him. So that was a really exciting thing.
Yes, and I saw the picture as soon as he took it, and so, I mean, there's no way it was altered or anything. It was a very exciting picture.
There's also a very haunted cemetery in Chattanooga, UTC Cemetery.
All right, well, the cemetery's down there. It's actually four connected cemeteries. There is the old Pauper Cemetery, which is not marked. You know, there are no marked graves there. That one has good reason for being active. Back when there was a medical school at UTC, the students were required to acquire their own cadavers, which were difficult and expensive if you were trying to purchase one. But the Pauper Cemetery was an easy place to get one for free. So not only were the medical students acquiring them there, but apparently Chattanooga had a good reputation with doctors from out of town, like Atlanta, for being, you know, you can get, you know, cheap cadavers from UTC. So there had been a lot of grave robbing there, to the extent that last I heard, they thought that about 90% of the bodies had been dug up from there. There had been, you know, I'd looked up newspaper accounts where they had prosecuted somebody for, you know, for grave robbing from there. You know, this wasn't just a rumor thing. There was some documentation about this. But that does tend to be an active spot. It's, if you ever go there, it's at the far left side of the cemetery. Then there's Citizen Cemetery, which is the oldest cemetery in Chattanooga after it was settled, and there are a lot of prominent citizens that are buried there. And that's where probably we spend, you know, a lot of the time when we're going through the cemetery, and have gotten a lot of activity there. Some with the electromagnetic field detectors, you know, we get those go off a lot, but also with the obelisk thumb. There is also a Confederate cemetery there. There is a little bit of conflict between some of the ghosts there because there are two Union soldiers that are buried there, and around the site where the Union soldiers are buried tend to be, you know, that tends to be where we get the most activity. And then the only cemetery portion that we don't go into is the Jewish cemetery, because that's still active. So we don't go into there. There are still people that are being, you know, interred there. But that's some of the history. There's one of our guides has a ghost that I think basically considers him a pet. That ghost's name is Tim, and he has talked to us many, many times. He always gives the same name. That one of the things that really convinced me about the obelisk is that we get on the campus and at the cemetery very distinct personalities that are always at the same portion that we go to. You know, up near the chapel, there's a suicide bride. She doesn't like men. She's very disparaging about them. She'll try to talk some of our, if we have a bridal party, she'll try to talk them out of, you know, a bachelorette party, try to talk them out of getting married. Tim is always down at the cemetery close to the edge. And he has said that he was a slave, that he had been hung from one of the trees there. Our impression is that he's around 17 years old. He is apparently gay because he flirts shamelessly with Donnie, our guide, who likes him. We had an 18-year-old young man who had come along with his mom on the ghost hunt before. And when we got to where Tim hangs out, it proceeded to describe his physical attributes in ways that embarrassed him horribly, but his mom thought it was hilarious. So Tim was apparently from like Civil War era.
It's very interesting, the information that comes out in a ghost hunt, not just, hey, look, there's a ghost over here, but now we're getting information about the individual and their personality traits, unique individual personality traits themselves.
There had been, I had read where one of the paranormal groups had done an investigation on campus. They were actually in Patton Chapel, and they had had an Indian ghost that they said just cussed them out in there. This wasn't us who was doing that one, but there's a very well-known Indian around here, Dragging Canoe, who, you know, back from the 1700s, I think, Dragging Canoe had been very, very adamant about they should not have made the deal with the government giving away basically most of the Indian lands in Tennessee and Kentucky. You know, this is like when they eventually wound up marching them on the Trail of Tears out to Oklahoma. But he had organized a lot of raids on a lot of the settlers, that kind of thing. Very angry ghost. So we assume that's who it was that was in the chapel. But on one of the very first hunts that we did, we had come to the part that's near where the seal is on campus. And the obelisk started, like Hope had said before, with down at the Reed House, it started giving some very specific directions, you know, quiet, stop, sit, talk, it didn't say talk. And then it had given the name Turtle. Well, Turtle at home was Dragging Canoe's brother and had, I think, been involved in some of that. So we thought, well, maybe it's the same family still hanging out around here.
Would you say that Chattanooga is a more haunted city than most?
Yes, there's actually a woman, her name escapes me right now, but she calls herself the Ghost Hunter's Ghost Hunter, and she's written about ghosts all over, and she says that Chattanooga is possibly the most haunted city next to New Orleans and Savannah. So I do believe there's a lot more activity here. For whatever reason, we do get, we get a lot of activity on our hunts, but we also get a lot of ghost photos, and not just orbs. I tell people often, there are some ghost tours that guarantee that you'll get ghost pictures, but every single one of those will always tell you, oh, you have to use a digital camera and you have to use a flash. Well, all they're doing is taking people past someplace dusty where they're getting reflections.
That's true. I too have been on tours, hunts, things of that nature, where it's like, well, if we stand right here, right by this very specific light pole, and you aim the camera in this exact direction, you're guaranteed to get an orb. And clearly, it's just a light refraction that gets some exciting reviews on TripAdvisor, but not an orb at all.
And all you will ever see on those people's website is orbs. Well, on our tour, we have a lot of people get faces and figures and mist and things that are clearly not, reflections like that. And we tell people, don't use your flash. Use an automatic setting if you have one. If not, just leave your flash off.
We get a face picture as recently as Saturday night. And yes, and we are very honest with people. I tell people at the beginning of my hunt, I want you to know when this is legitimate activity and when it's not, because it's more exciting if you know when something is actually happening. So I say, if you take your EMF detector under a red light or a power pole, it's going to go off, and that's not a ghost. But I've been working with Amy, I've been working for Amy over 9 years now, and I've had just too many experiences to brush away. So I would say that is definitely accurate, that Chattanooga is one of the more haunted towns.
I'd mentioned Donnie before, who frequently does the UTC and cemetery hunt. He had a group a while back, and they had gone through the campus, and you have to cross the street from the UTC campus to get into the cemetery. Well, they were just about to step off the curb to cross the street when the obelisk, the one that talks, said, distress, distress, which, held them up for a second or two because it startled them. Well, right then, a drunk driver came flying around the curve, wrecked right in front of them, would have hit them had it not been for the obelisk. So I like to tell people that, you know, clearly some of our ghosts like Donnie, and that's good for you too.
Why is Chattanooga such a haunted city?
I think it's because there's really a perfect storm of unusual history that all adds together. I don't think it's just one thing, but I mean, going back, Amy mentioned earlier that there's the Native American history going back, you know, way far back, and there's going to be, you know, issues from that that would cause ghost activity, like earlier tribes that haven't been memorialized being upset at the attention that these days paid to the Cherokee history in, you know, downtown near the river. There's a whole area devoted to that, and, you know, there's things going on there. There's the Civil War history, like Amy said, that's part of it, but there's just so much more. There's so many different things that have happened here through the years that can add together to be that perfect storm that leads to all the activity.
And Chattanooga has had its fair share of violence, more so than a lot of cities compared to what its size is, and I think that has something to do with it.
To find out more about the ghosts of Chattanooga and Chattanooga Ghost Tours, you can visit their website at ChattanoogaGhostTours.com. A special thanks to Amy Petula and Hope Holloway for joining us on the show today. That wraps up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, please press subscribe on whatever platform it is you listen to us on. That greatly helps us, as does leaving a positive review. If you take a few moments to do that, we would greatly appreciate it. A couple stars, that helps us grow in those rankings as well and lets other folks know that we exist. We could not continue on with the show without that support. Until next time, thanks for listening to The Grave Talks. I'm Tony Bruschi.